Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by my firm, Herity & Herity, the go-to firm for the PAN 300 for PAN preparation and prosecution. Today, we're lucky to be joined by Judge Ellen Albright from the Waco Division of the Western District of Texas. He's become known as the PAN community's go-to judge. Before Judge Albright was confirmed at the end of 2018, less than 10 PAN cases were filed in the Waco Division in all of its history. 2020 alone, Judge Albright took on almost 800 new PAN cases, about 20% of all new PAN cases filed last year in America. So thank you so much for joining. Before we begin, I want to say that we talk a lot about creating moments of magic in my firm. And when I was scheduling this interview, every interaction that I had with your deputy and your clerk, Evan Pearson, was a true moment of magic. And I'm not sure if it's because they're based in Texas or specifically in the Western District of Texas, or it's because they work for you. But that kind of really stood out to me. And I feel like just that experience alone kind of answered a lot of the questions that I had about your court. So I wanted to share that with my podcast listeners before we dived into our conversation.
You're nice to say that. I have definitely emphasized with my everyone from anyone who works in the courthouse is part of the family. I've told them that I hope they channel my outlook on how to treat people.
Yeah, and it was amazing to see. I think I told almost every person afterwards. It was just such a pleasant interactions. So the question that I like to start with is, do you remember when you first learned about patents, and did you have any opinions about the role that they played?
So I learned about patents in the 90s. I was a magistrate judge in Austin, and I worked with two district judges who, it would be fair to say, did not embrace the concept of handling patent cases. And so what was the line, you know, in the candy commercial, you know, give it to the kid, he'll eat anything. Lawyers almost by default started asking me to do things just to help out with the docket, Markman hearings, and eventually, you know, handled patent trials as a magistrate judge. And I realized what an amazing combination it is to be a patent trial lawyer, to have to combine both strong trial lawyer skills, with having to learn an awful lot about technology, learning a lot about patent law. And so with an unbelievable amount of hubris, when I left the bench, I just threw myself out there for really no good reason, said, oh, I can try these cases. And fortunately, I was able to fool enough people for long enough that I was able to do it for 20 years or 18 years or so before I got this job.
Yeah. And you were actually, I think, the youngest magistrate judge at the time you were appointed. What kind of law did you practice before you became a magistrate judge?
I've had two periods of my life of unbelievable good timing as a lawyer. Before I went on the bench was right when the law changed state by state in all 50 states to enable insureds to sue their insurance companies for first party bad faith.
Yeah.
And that happened as I was kind of growing up as a young trial lawyer. And I was at a firm where they had a lot of, without ever meaning to get that kind of work, they had a lot of insurance clients who all of a sudden were saying, what do you mean if I deny a claim, they can sue me? That doesn't seem to work. And so I did that kind of litigation. I also did a fair amount of employment litigation, got to go to handle several trials, and then went on the bench in 92. And again, divine intervention, and I mean that sincerely, just as I was leaving the bench in 99 and thinking I would like to try to do patent litigation, is really, as you know, it all kind of exploded in that time period.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, once you got to private practice, and I will probably talk about Eastern District of Texas in a little bit, but generally, I guess, what were the issues that you saw being in private practice, handling patent cases? what were the issues that you kind of encountered with the way patent cases were being handled by judges? Did you start kind of forming?
Well, of course, you know, when I started, they're kind of like the odd elephant, I don't even know if when I started, I don't remember when Markman, for example, was decided. So I don't know that when I started, there even were Markman hearings. I don't think there were by 99. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But and each judge is having to deal with, it'd be like if suddenly every 10th case of mine was a bankruptcy case. And I had to actually understand what a creditor was and a debtor was and what a rule X was. You know, the biggest issue, I think, was that most judges were just unfamiliar with patent litigation. And for example, if someone comes in and they're arguing invalidity and they're like, that's not a 102, that's a 103. If you're a non-patent guy, you don't even know where to go. You can't even Google that, right? It's like Google 102 and 103, find out what the difference is. And that's kind of an easy concept as long as you can break the Latin code. And so, I think I kind of grew up as a patent trial lawyer as the courts were growing up and learning how to deal with these cases. And I was blessed to work with some phenomenally great patent trial lawyers who were very patient and helped teach me. I started off on kind of the softer side of it. I would do the damages. I would do the willful. Back then, willfulness was a part of the trial usually. And as I did more and more, by the time I left practice, I was able to handle pretty much every aspect of a patent case, whether it was putting on an inventor or putting on a technical expert or crossing an expert, which is kind of normal. I mean, it's like going from high school to college to pro. By the time I'd been doing it for 5 to 10, 15 years, I was able to handle a lot more.
I know you mentioned when you were a magistrate judge, the district court judges that you worked for, they kind of didn't want anything to do with the patent cases. So was the delay caused in some of these patent trials because the district court judges were like, all right, we can maybe in 3 years I'll be in the mood to handle it? Or is that?
I think the perception was among most judges is were two at that time. And they're not all that different for some now. One is we've got an incredibly busy docket. Every case is important. And the patent cases seem to take up an inordinate, one patent case takes up what seven different cases take up in terms of my time and effort. And so there's a real time crunch. And the other is, if you don't understand why issues are important to the lawyers in patent cases, they can seem very trivial to you if you're a judge just sitting there like, why are these people fighting over X? And I know that both of the judges, district judges I was a magistrate for, kind of had that perception about every discovery dispute. And so it was even worse in a patent case. And now, having practiced all those years, I get that 99% of the time, while it may appear that the dispute is trivial, it's really important. And it's very binary. And whatever I rule is going to, not maybe dramatically, but it's going to have an impact. And so when I handle lots and lots of discovery hearings, I don't have discovery motions. I have people call and we say, I had a discovery hearing this afternoon, and I like to make myself available. And what I try to do is stay patient, number one, and number two, always work to come up with a solution that's fair to both sides. And that may require me to think outside the box a little bit, but it goes back to, I know why they're fighting over this stuff, and I know it's not trivial. I know that it is, in the scheme of 100 things, it may be less important, but it's almost never trivial. It almost always has to get resolved because the clients need it to be resolved, the lawyers need to be resolved, and it's important.
there's a, maybe it's unfair, but there's a common perception about the way defense attorneys approach patent cases is they just want to drag it out as long as possible until the patent owner gives up in some way, or just to try to avoid trial at all costs. Do you think that's a fair characterization? And do you think it's a problem? And I guess the last part of that is, how does that play into how a judge should handle a patent case, knowing that one of the sides, you know, they might be playing every trick in the book to kind of avoid?
You know, I did both defense cases and plaintiff's cases. So I always, one of my pitches to the public is always, you know, I try to be as fair as possible. I don't think writ large, that's what defense lawyers do. But that being said, you know, for example, when I first got here, I probably had 4 out of every 5 cases that were filed, I got a motion to dismiss. I dealt with them relatively quickly, and I don't get very many motions to dismiss anymore. I was very careful when I started. You know, we've set up rules, we have a committee, which is committee only in the sense of you can join it if you'd like. Everyone in the world can join it. It's open to lawyers and clients and whoever want to help contribute to, you know, sort of the things like protective orders, you know, scheduling orders and all that. And I want as much input as possible. But at the end of the day, if someone files a case here, unless it's very unusual, they know that they're going to have a Markman within a certain period of time, assuming they can both get ready. And they also know that the trial will be set within a relatively certain period of time after that. And so I don't get the sense that I have an issue with defense lawyers, you know, just trying to run up the bills or do anything that's inappropriate. I find that the vast majority of lawyers are doing whatever they feel like they need to do. But again, that's why I've made my court very open to either counsel. If they're having an issue with the other counsel, just call my law clerk and I'll have a hearing as quickly as possible. And so far, it's usually been within a day or two or less of when they ask me for a hearing. And I actually think that if, for example, if you and opposing counsel both know that if one of you says, well, if we can't work this out, we're going to call the judge, and you actually can mean it, and you actually know that I will take the call and I actually will resolve it, I think most stuff gets worked out because I'm available. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a discovery hearing set and an hour before they say they were able to work it out. I think me making myself available inspired them to work it out.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned, you know, defendants filing motions to dismiss, but obviously I don't think it's a secret that a lot of them file motions to transfer cases, motions to delay trials. I mean, in totality, obviously there's might be good faith reasons for doing all that, but you know, as a layman, let's say looking at that and they're saying, well, they're not focused on the merits of the case. They're focused on these tangential issues to kind of, I guess, avoid discussing validity and infringement and damages. Do you think that kind of, maybe not you specifically, but as a trial judge, how do you kind of go through all that and then say, all right, let's I'll take your merits argument seriously after that, after you've done all that to kind of avoid it?
See, I don't have that perception at all. I think if a party believes that they don't belong in this court and they file a motion to transfer, that's absolutely their right to do. And we take every motion to transfer as seriously as possible and try and be as fair as possible in resolving it. If it's a motion to dismiss, then same. I mean, I want to deal with it. Now, there are issues, though, that, again, writ large, I think over time we've come to expedite. And let me give you an example. On a regular basis, a plaintiff will say, say there's indirect infringement or willful, whatever, it doesn't matter. And I would get a hearing a week with the fight over, they can't say it now, they need, whatever. I mean, I get why the plaintiff wanted it in there. I'm not putting them down. I get why the defendant didn't want it in there. I'm not putting them down. But pretty quickly I decided, having hearings, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze. So basically, I just came up with a one-size-fits-all rule that I will dismiss all those claims without prejudice until the Markman. The parties have 3 months after the Markman to amend their pleadings to add those claims back in. They don't need to ask for leave to add them back in. Leave has already been given. And they can conduct discovery on those issues, even if they're not alleged in the pleading. And as the word has gotten out, that's how I'm going to handle these issues. Parties have stopped fighting over them because they know what I'm going to do. But I don't discourage people from having discovery disputes and coming to me. I don't in any way discourage defendants from filing motions to transfer if they believe the case. You know, I've transferred several cases to other jurisdictions when we found that was appropriate. We just, you know, we did it this week. So I really believe that I always try to believe the best in lawyers, that they're doing, that what they're doing is what's best for their clients. And if they believe a motion to transfer is appropriate, then, you know, I have no, I think they should, and we'll take it up.
So I know you mentioned that you started practicing patent law as an attorney at a good time in the late 90s, 2000. I actually have this copy of the New York Times with a picture of Judge Ward in Marshall, Texas from 2006. And coincidentally, that was my first year of law school. I remember reading it. It made a big impression on me. I guess, what did you think of the time? Obviously, you were right there close by what he was doing. And what did you learn from that?
I'm not going to be able to help you out much there. I never had the pleasure of appearing in front of Judge Ward. And actually, my good fortune in getting into patent litigation had almost nothing to do with the Eastern District and what happened. I benefited from the fact that in the late 90s, we had all the IPOs and companies went public. And then those companies had patents that they needed to assert against competitors. So, I mean, don't hold me to this 100%, but I think probably the first five trials I had were of plaintiffs who, like I said, had gotten a cornerstone patent for their business. Someone else was infringing it to compete, and they didn't care at all about the Eastern District. They needed us to sue somewhere and stop the infringement and to get an injunction. And so now I ultimately wound up practicing quite a fair amount in the Eastern District as my career matured. And, you know, I tried cases in Sherman and Marshall and Tyler. I had cases in Texarkana. And so, but my career really wasn't that tied to what Judge Ward did in the Eastern District.
But I'm guessing you were still kind of following what was happening there. I guess, were you surprised that, you know, when I read this article, I thought, well, maybe a judge in Alaska or a judge in Detroit might decide to follow this example. Were you surprised that no other judges outside of Eastern District kind of tried to streamline patent cases in that same way until really you became a judge, kind of?
Actually, I kept thinking, man, someone in Hawaii. and part of the reason for that was, you know, if you're suing Asian companies, it would be, you know, it would be halfway, you know,
that's a good point,
between in terms of what that judge did in Eastern District, I think it's what he did that was so insightful in many ways was making it so that there was great predictability once you filed in the Eastern. A couple of things that I tried to imitate. I was going to say emulate, but I mean actually copyright theft write down. one is if someone got sued in the Eastern District, it was relatively easy to know when things would happen. You know, after a short period of time, clients could predict, you know, when things happen. Combine that with someone who worked very, very hard. You don't have the docket that he had, or for example, you know, that some of the other current judges in the Eastern District have. without really, really working hard. And then third, I think you have to enjoy it and enjoy those kind of cases and be willing to work hard on those cases. You know, I've always told my kids, you know, find what you love. And I tried to explain to them that if someone had told me that when I was at a firm that for the next 2 years, they're going to double my salary, but I was going to have to do environmental law, I would have said, that's not going to work. I wouldn't have understood it. I wouldn't have enjoyed it. And every day would have been work. I think when you have a situation like what I have here, where I'm getting to preside over cases that have some of the finest lawyers in America, not just maybe in a lawsuit like the one I tried a couple weeks ago, but literally every day in almost every Markman hearing, I have exceptional lawyers from all over the United States appearing in front of me. And so it's, you know, it makes this job great to get to interact with lawyers who are the quality that I'm getting to interact with. And so every day I come to work, I'm extremely happy.
And I think that kind of answers the question of why you wanted to attract patent cases, because you love handling them.
For example, tomorrow, I have two Markmans in the morning and I'm picking a jury in the afternoon. You know, that's a lot of work, but I'm not complaining. I'm saying I'm thrilled that I'm going to have two Markmans in the morning and then pick up a jury for a patent trial in the afternoon. I don't see how I could get any luckier than to get to work with everyone. I know the lawyers are going to be outstanding. I love trials. I love patent trials. And so, I feel unbelievably blessed. But to maintain the docket that's, you know, happened in Waco, I can't say, well, I'm going to do a voir dire tomorrow, and that's enough work for a day, and, you know, go somewhere and eat donuts. I mean, you know, last year I think we handled over 50 Markmans. We're on pace. I think we may break that, you know, before summer this year. And, you know, it's work, but I enjoy every minute of it. So it's not really work.
Yeah. In the article, actually, Judge Ward joked that he shot himself in the foot by streamlining the process too much.
Well, I got to talk to Judge Ward. I never appeared in front of him, but you know, he was absolutely a bigger than life kind of person, bigger than life judge, bigger than life lawyer. He was really an exceptional man.
So you were talking about how many cases you're handling, and I think the last statistic they released, you're handling last year, you got almost 800 new cases, which is 20% of all patent cases, and I guess that just sounds like a big number. So can you give us a sense of how you're able to handle so many cases? Because I'm just imagining, what if each one of those sets of cases have a discovery dispute or something like that? How is that even?
Well, fortunately, the Fifth Circuit has given me an extra clerk. I have four clerks, three of whom have technical backgrounds. I'm now using a technical advisor who worked with me for a year and a half as a clerk. That helps. I'm going to be getting a new magistrate. Unfortunately, I was hoping to get it in this April, but the government couldn't afford to have that many new magistrates because they're really restraining their spending right now. And so my magistrate will happen next April. So, you know, that will add another judge, two more law clerks. We also have a very, very vigorous intern program. We've got a great law school here at Baylor. We've got a great law school down the road at UT, and we've got SMU and a lot of others. And last summer, I think we had between 16 and 20 interns working really full time to get stuff done. And so ultimately, it will become tougher when, for example, if I actually am in trial every week, I'm supposed to be in trial for the next 8 weeks, let's say, it would be tough to squeeze a Markman in or a discovery hearing in because it's really kind of nonstop trials. But probably one or two will settle, or if they don't, I'll do it at lunch, or I'll do it at five, or I'll do it in the morning or whatever. I think it's just a matter of working hard. But it doesn't really seem like work.
So you were a magistrate judge, you were a law clerk as well. I guess, how do you decide what you handle versus what you kind of delegate to your technical advisor or to?
Oh, I think at this point, because of the amount of time, I'm actually physically engaging lawyers. 90% of the work is turned over to the law clerks to review and prepare. And then we discuss everything before the hearings, and they get me ready. But when my first year here, when the docket was, relatively modest and all that, I had plenty of time, and I was working on, I was writing orders and I was doing things. That time has gone. And, now in a typical day, again, like tomorrow, I'll start a markman at 8:30. I'll start a second one at 10:30. I'll be picking a jury at 1:30. There's not going to be a lot of bandwidth in there for me to write an order. But I'm doing what I love. I'm going to love handling the markmans. My law clerks and I, have already prepared and sent out the preliminary constructions, and I'm looking forward to the voir dire. I like being in the courtroom.
I wanted to get your sense of about a few more, I guess, Eastern District versus Western District of Texas issues. Do you feel, obviously, I'm sure you know a lot of the judges from the Eastern District of Texas, if not all of them. Do you feel like you're in some friendly competition in terms of handling patent cases in the best way possible? Do you view it like that? Do you think it's a positive thing for the system to kind of?
I don't see it as competition at all. Let me explain why. Number one, I think I've stolen most of what I'm doing from whatever I thought the Eastern District did really well. I've taken it, and I'm hoping not to get sued. Number two, the Eastern District judges are still getting an incredible number of patent cases. Marshall, they were up some huge percent last year. I know that the judges in Plano and Sherman have as much as they can say grace over. So I still feel today the way I felt when I took the bench, which was with the change of T.C. Heartland and a more limited ability to be in the Eastern District, that if there was not another safety valve place for people to file patent cases, then they were going to migrate naturally to Delaware, where it was already overcrowded, or California, where they're equally, they've got huge dockets, they've got huge criminal dockets. I saw then, and I still see today, me as being just an alternative venue to the venues that have a lot of patent cases. And so, and to be honest, every time I have, I did this week, I had two questions that came up that I wasn't sure how to deal with. And the first thing I did was call my friends who were judges in the Eastern District and say, how do I do this? And so, I am very close to many, if not all, of the judges in the Eastern District, and I don't see it as a rivalry at all. I'm happy for every case they get at this point. I think it's great. And I probably what I've done is helped ease the burden a little bit in Delaware.
And I know you joked that before that what you do is not a trade secret. All your orders are publicly available. People can see what you do. And is it fair to say, encourage other district court judges to kind of take what you're doing and implement in their districts. Do you think it will happen? Do you think, now that they see you've done it, will kind of, are the other judges contacting you from other districts and say, is it something I should consider or is it?
I haven't had anyone who has shown any great interest in getting more than one patent case. I've had a number of judges who get a patent case and call and say, what do I do now? And I'm happy to help. And we're going to see that, I think, a little bit more, too, because the Patent Pilot Project is either has expired or will expire this year. And so, you know, you, for example, I don't know exactly what they'll do in the Northern District of Texas, but for example, it may mean that they'll move away from getting all patent cases to the small number of judges they had to going to any judge that, I don't know how they assign things in the Northern District, but my sense is judges who have not been getting patent cases in the Northern District, especially Dallas, will start getting them.
I guess we'll see how that, maybe they'll like them and they'll want more.
Well, I hope so. Come on in, the water's fine.
I came across an interesting article about by a jury consultant. He was talking about the difference between Eastern District and the Western District. And one thing he said is that, you know, in Eastern District of Texas, the people there collectively, they're more, they prioritize private property rights, while in the Western District of Texas, have a more Western attitude, and they're more concerned about independence, about doing what they want. You've obviously, you know, you're a judge in Waco, and you've practiced all over the Eastern District of Texas, but are the communities different, I guess, in terms of the way they might perceive patent cases? Or do you think it's always
difficult? No, I don't think I did. And I have both, in the Eastern District, I tried cases both as a plaintiff and a defendant, won some, lost some. But I, you know, I don't know that I would really be able to tell you the difference between the juries I had in Marshall and Tyler and Sherman and the juries I had in San Diego and Tacoma.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most places, I mean, I'm sure I'm not, I don't want to sound naive. I think probably if you had a place that was unique, like a New York City or, you know, I think that you can find yours there. But, you know, like the San Diego division, you know, that's huge. I mean, you've got people who have great, a lot of technical background, but you've got people in a lot of other counties who might not. And that's essentially the equivalent to what we have in Waco, and it's what you have in Tyler. I certainly think there you can identify some things about divisions that may impact them. For example, Waco has one very large and a total of three universities. We've got, you know, big medical, you know, hospitals here and, you know, big medical centers. We've got SpaceX here now. So, you know, we're getting a lot of technical people. And so, you know, I think in every area, you have kind of the same mix of people and their backgrounds and all that, that, you know, when you're trying to pick a jury for a patent case. And I didn't then and don't buy in now that there is an Eastern District culture and a Western District culture. I think the divisions may differ, again, like for the reasons I just said, they may have certain attributes or not, but I think trying to patent case is trying to patent case.
That's interesting. You know, actually your clerk suggested I ask you about hiring local counsel, but I was wondering if you could, I guess, give your perspective about what you think makes for effective patent litigation counsel, and effective patent litigation counsel specifically in the Waco Division of Western District of Texas.
Well, it's like saying what would make a great pro football quarterback. You know, you have Patrick Mahomes who can run and can throw from any position 80 yards, and then you have Tom Brady who I don't think can run at all, and but is, you know, is a master. I think it's the same in patent case as any other case, which is when you find unicorns who have extraordinary or very high level of technical understanding, their understanding is good enough that they can then teach it to a jury through the witnesses, and then they also know how to be a trial lawyer. You know, that's the unicorn everyone's looking for. I would say most patent trial lawyers tend to be more of one than the other. They either are great trial lawyers who have adapted and learned the technical sides and the law and all that. I don't want I would say that's described me. I won't start by saying I was a great trial lawyer, but I was saying my talent base was being a trial lawyer. And over 20 years, I scrambled hard and learned to be as good a technical lawyer as I could. I think there are many people who are very strong technically, but they're not naturally gifted trial lawyers. But, you know, you do enough work and you can become a good trial lawyer. And then occasionally you have the Patrick Mahomes or, you know, who has both of those skills. And then you have a pretty lethal trial lawyer in a patent case. I mean, the best math teacher you're ever going to have is someone who really, really, really understands math, understands it so well that when they're explaining it to you, they can make it simple enough for you to understand. But, you know, that's not that deep. You know, if you're defending or prosecuting a doctor in a medical malpractice case, it's the same thing. You know, you have to be smart enough to understand the medicine, but a good enough trial lawyer to try the case. So there's nothing unique about that in patent litigation.
And I know you get this question probably asked way too much, but I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about the PTAB. You know, somebody might be listening to this interview and say, well, you know, Judge Albright has so many cases, maybe he should just stay all of them until the PTAB makes its decisions regarding validity. I'm guessing you won't think that's a good idea. And I guess, can you kind of describe your thinking about the role that the PTAB plays versus your court and...
Oh, sure. I think I'm pretty on the record on this after 2.5 years. It's a pretty simple equation to me. Patents are found in the Constitution. My job was created in the Constitution. Juries were created in the Constitution. If someone has a patent that was issued by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and they in good faith believe someone is infringing it, the only place they can file that is in a federal court. And they're entitled to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment, and they're entitled to have an Article III judge who's been confirmed by the Senate. And if you have all those things, I think people are entitled to have a trial. Now, along the way, you know, I may grant a summary judgment where they don't get to trial, or a Daubert where arguments aren't made. I mean, I don't shirk my role, but my belief is that a person who in good faith has brought a patent litigation case deserves to get a jury trial in that case.
I think that sums it up pretty well. You talked about discovery, and I think you said that most of the, you know, discovery disputes that lawyers come to you are very reasonable and they're critical decisions and you understand why they're coming to you with that. You know, during your practice and what you've seen now, do you think lawyers have become more reasonable about discovery in terms of limiting, you know, the scope of discovery and really trying to go after?
I think you're kidding. No, I don't think they've become more reasonable. I just think they know in my court that I'm going to know why they're asking for something and whether they ought to ask for what they're, you know. I mean, I'm joking, but seriously, I think after 2.5 years and God knows how many hundred discovery hearings I've had and Markman hearings I've had and now a couple of trials, I think most lawyers know that they can't call and say, we don't want to do something and we're acting in good faith. Blah, 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 blah. When the lawyers call, I know I've been on both sides of 95% of these issues. I know why the plaintiff wants it. I know why the defendant doesn't want to give it. What I always aim to do is make sure that everyone has a fair chance to get stuff. But I try to be very fair to both sides. And so most of my discovery hearings wind up being kind of Socratic, not imperial, for lack of a better word. It's, I ask the, you know, tell the plaintiff, I need to know exactly what you want. If I were to order the defendant to do something, tell me exactly the words you want me to use. And when they do, I'll turn to the defendant and say, those sound reasonable to me. Tell me why you can't do that. And sometimes they'll not have a good reason, that moves pretty fast, but sometimes it'll be, well, it's more how we do it. I'll give you a perfect example. I bet you between last March and last, make up a month, June or July, I can't tell you how many hearings I had where lawyers on both sides were acting totally in good faith to try and get, to try and exchange source code and to try and get discovery done during COVID, where people couldn't travel, people, you know, couldn't, and by travel, I mean, they couldn't travel across the city. And so, and, you know, and in those cases, I was never unhappy or angry. In every one of those cases, I basically was just negotiating, okay, what's to the defendant? What's the best you can do in terms of getting this stuff to the plaintiff? Okay, what's the best you can do in terms of getting your expert here? I mean, I've ordered, or not ordered, but I told them, besides, if you really want me to give you this relief, you've got to buy a gun safe and put it in wherever your guy is. And it's got to be a big gun safe that, you know, like a 500 pound gun safe. And he and one other person can have the code. They're going to keep it stored in there. They're going to have only a laptop to work on that part of it. It can't be connected to anything. The laptop's going to be kept in there. And then you guys can figure out how to transfer what he's put on his laptop to something in his report. But in other words, so I found the vast majority of my times, I was just trying to come up with a solution. It wasn't lawyers who just couldn't. I have the lawyers who can't get along occasionally, but most of the time it was over folks who needed my help to come up with a resolution. And I was always happy to do that.
So it seems, I guess, at least in the lawyers who, most of the lawyers who speak with you, they're kind of in agreement about what they should exchange. It's really about kind of a dispute about.
No, I don't. Now on the source code they were, but I think on most things they're not in agreement. But when I challenge the side who doesn't want to produce something to why they shouldn't have to, I can usually come to a meeting in the middle once I understand why one side wants it, why one side doesn't want to give it, or how it should be done. I can usually come up with a way. I think that most, again, it's not egotistical, but I think most times the lawyers feel like I've done kind of a Solomon job of coming up with a resolution that's the best for both of them.
Let's say, you know, there's a lawyer who's going to be trying a case litigating a case in your court, and he wants to figure out, well, what can I do to even help streamline the case even more? You know, there's all these great rules, but I just want to be, you know, the best, you know, do the best possible job in terms of streamlining a case, keeping it tight. Any advice in terms of that, what they can do to make cases even more efficient and kind of help that process?
Well, let me focus first on trial, and that's really easy. It's hard to do, but it's easy for me to say. I mean, just, you know, really figure out early on which exhibits you want to use, that you're actually going to use in trial. I'm sure you've seen where you walk into, in the old days when we had binders before COVID, you know, you walk into a patent trial and there'd be 700 binders of exhibits. And I always thought, man, I wish I was selling binders. But, figure out early on what exhibits you want to use. Have those ready to go. Have them, you know, so those can be done. You exchange those so that can be done quickly. And more than anything, just constantly work to skinny down your case to whatever the minimum it is that you can. Every judge says this, every trial lawyer ignores it, but the truth is that lawyers always, always, always go too long on anything that they do. Take whatever you think is an appropriate opening, write it down, finish it, and then have someone who hates you listen to it and have you help cut 20% out of it, because it's at least 20% too long, no matter what. If you're doing a direct, again, have someone who hates you and be honest with you, listen to it, and cut out 10% or 50%, you know, just every, we're all, as trial lawyers, we're so afraid to not get everything in that we can. Everything. There's one more thing. Oh, I can't not say that. That's the best approach I can tell people is the least approach. Now, you know, everything you really do need in needs to get in, but you need to have someone needs to be sure and kind of get you focused on what really needs to be put in. And then other than that, make sure your equipment works. You know, in my court, and again, this might be a little tougher as I have more and more trials to have this deal, but for example, the trial I have coming up on Monday, you know, it's funny because lawyers still talk to me with the great fear that people seem to have of federal judges. And one of them kind of timidly asked if it'd be okay if they could come in the courtroom and get their stuff set up, that kind of thing. And I said, to the contrary, I think it was Monday. I said, you have all week. You can go into my courtroom anytime you want from 7:30 to 5 and set your stuff up. I was a trial lawyer. I want to do whatever I can do to make this as easy on you as possible. Might be a little tougher if I'm using the courtroom all week. But we might have to open it up on the weekends so that, you know, they can get in. But my feeling is I need to be as aggressively cooperative with trial lawyers as possible to make it as easy as I can on them to try their case. I don't ever, even though I'm sure every time someone's lost, they walk out of there and say, man, that judge wasn't very good. My goal still is to make the lawyers feel at the end of the trial like I was just an umpire, you know, balls right. And strikes, and I didn't care who won.
You mentioned that obviously most patent cases settle, but you do see the cases that do go to trial. I guess, what do you think separates the cases that kind of where they're able to come to an agreement versus those that they end up in a trial where, I guess, one party is bound to be unhappy?
I don't have enough data yet. I've only had two trials, and so I could guess why those didn't settle, but it'd be a wild guess. And so, you know, like anything, I think it's when the parties, the most likely is, just from my experience, when one party is either asking for so much money, their side says, we're just going to go trial, or the other side is only offering so little money that the plaintiff says, I got to go to trial. I mean, that's, you know, the most likely. But, you know, that's why I'm trying to say everything I can for trial, though, because no one is going to settle unless it's Thursday or Friday or Saturday or Sunday or Monday morning and, you know, we're picking a jury.
Yeah.
And so that's the optimum time that people will sell. By the way, it's the optimum time.
After they set up their equipment.
Right. Well, it's also optimum, you know, in criminal cases, you know, we have a lot of conversions the weekend before we start the trial where they decide at that moment they're going to plead guilty, you know, because in another day or so they're going to go to trial and they can't undo that. So
I think I heard you say once that you think it's extremely important for patent cases to get resolved in a relatively quick period of time. But, you know, you see the situations where even after a party wins a trial, you know, a decade or more can pass till there's some kind of resolution. And I know that's probably after they leave your courtroom that those situations happen. I guess, do you have any advice about, you know, are there any changes that could happen for the system as a whole to kind of try to improve that where, you know, that it doesn't take a decade to kind of reach a resolution?
I don't know about that directly. I know that probably an area where district judges, I'm sure, continue to feel like we could get more help would be in the area of what is really the way to do damages and what isn't. I think for a lot of those cases that have a long tenure of going up and down, I think it has to do with were the damages properly calculated. And, you know, we're all doing, as district judges, the best we can. You know, we're all doing what we can on Daubert to you know, be a gatekeeper. But you know, there's the balance between being a gatekeeper and then allowing a party to put on its case and what can be accomplished under cross-examination. But I think the vast majority of cases don't have the 10-year lifespan. I think the vast majority, they get resolved at trial, and then there's an appeal, and then it's over.
I think in terms of clarifying those issues, I actually heard Chief Judge Michel, he recently said that, I guess in reference to Federal Circuit, that sometimes a decision is based on what randomly drawn panel you get. And I know your confirmation hearing, you talked about the importance of a trial judge finding out what the precedent is and following it. How does that impact your work as a district judge when it seems that the panels are not in line with each other?
Well, it's no mystery that if you can find decisions from different panels that are not consistent, it makes it tougher to make sure that we're getting it right. But I think all we can do as district judges is try and figure out what we think the best ruling is from the circuit, apply it, and you know, and go from there. And we work my staff and I, and I know all the, you know, the judges I know well that do patent cases, the ones in Delaware, the ones in California, the ones in the Eastern District, Texas. You know, we're all doing the very best we can to apply circuit law the best that we can. But on the other hand, in a lot of ways, you know, we're a mass unit. You know, for example, the trial that I have that starts in a couple of weeks, it won't be unusual for me to have half dozen to a dozen discrete disputes, every one of which is probably going to, it takes my just 51, 49 best assessment, and every one of them, which, you know, whichever way I go, maybe an appellate point. You know, not most, but a lot of what we do as trial judges is really just trying to be good trial judges. And it's not having to apply circuit law as much as just trying to do what's fair to the parties.
That makes sense. I have a few final questions. I'm sure you know there's a lot of IP press coverage of almost everything that you do. Do you follow it?
Like, you don't say.
Yeah. Do you follow it? What's that like to kind of, you know, everybody overanalyzing almost every little thing and every little decision and every order and so forth? Does that impact your work?
Oh, I, you know, no. You know, we a couple of days ago when we transferred a case, I forget how they described it, but there's a headline, something like, you know, I did something with the, you know, avoided the Federal Circuit or something by transferring a case. And I thought, well, number one, I really didn't, in the sense that the party that I rule against could mandamus it too. I mean, you know, the mandamus isn't just for the people who didn't get the transfer. It might be the people who did transfer it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the press is just kind of amusing in a lot of ways. But the way I see it is, I'm not involved in any way at trying to obtain press. You know, I love doing, for example, these type of question and answers, CLEs or whatever I can do. I've never turned one down. Anyone who's asked me to speak to a group of any kind, because I think people who hear what my thoughts are and how I do things. I think transparency is a phenomenally good thing. But I'm not doing anything from my end to generate any press.
Right, yeah.
I'm just, I'm
wasn't,
trying cases.
I wasn't suggesting that at all.
I try cases, I handle Markmans, I rule on motions. It's all kind of vanilla stuff. And, you know, it's and so it's interesting to me that people would be interested in reading that a Waco judge handled a motion to transfer one way or the other or not. You know, it's, but if there is an upside to it, you know, it's in this job, it is, I hope I never get to the point where I'm not continuing to evolve. You know, there was press recently about the fact that some of my hearings were sealed. You know, so I reached out immediately to the parties, to, and it's not an easy thing to do where you have a Zoom call and you know, if there's stuff that needs to be sealed, what do? You know, and how do you have a hearing and not let people in? So that being said, I immediately went back to the parties, and they are now providing redacted versions of transcripts of every, you know, of all the hearings that we've had. And so I think in that sense, if something in the press is brought to my attention where I can improve what I'm doing, you know, I got no ego in that regard. You know, I am happy to take the advice. I'm sure all of which was given in a good nature to me, but I am committed and I'm going to do everything I can to make everything I'm doing as transparent as possible. You know, the Intel case, you know, we had on, you could listen in to the entire thing by Zoom on the phone. So, you know, I'm certainly totally committed to being transparent.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know your middle name is the letter G. Is there some story behind that?
The best I can tell you is that my father, who was in the Marines, had a friend who's only had initials, literally just whatever they were.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to just have initials. He thought that was pretty neat. And I assume my mom threatened that, you know, she would hold out and not have me until they negotiated a settlement. And so somewhere in there, it turned out to be Alan D. Without a period, Albright. And this is more than you wanted to know, but if you Google me, you'll, like, for everyone, this is an every federal judge story, is we all have to do a Senate judiciary questionnaire that is made public, and mine's public. Well, one of the things that took me an enormous amount of time was deciding whether or not to include a period after my D or not, because there was a worry that some would think that it was a typographical error by leaving the period off. And so we went round and round for more time than you can imagine on the mysterious period after the D as I was going through this process. So, but ultimately I held out and it's Alan Dino period Albright. So,
well, that's a great story. Let's say somebody's listening to this and maybe a law student or an attorney, and his dream is to clerk for you. Any advice that you would give them?
Oh, sure. You will get extra points if you have a good technical background in any area. On one hand, I have a law clerk who's a chemistry background and one that has geology background. But if you have had a clerk who has a PhD in electrical engineering. So that's certainly a big plus. But I have had and will have law clerks who don't have a technical background. So it's not a requirement. But other than that, what I would do is try and figure out if you can do an internship here. You know, contact us about doing an internship after your first year. My law clerks are intimately involved with interns we have. They kind of figure out which ones are, you know, like anything, are there, you know, they kind of rate them. And we get great ones across the board, but, you know, there's always one or two who stand out. And the great thing about that situation is that's both where I'm going to get clerks, but also if we have something very special, I can reach out to the dozens of judges that I know and say, you know, here's someone that I think is really special. Another way of doing it, though, is I think I'm going to be in a situation where if people are willing to take a year off from their firm and come clerk, I have a law clerk that's starting in August I've lost track, but I think he may have already put in 3 years as an associate at a Washington, D.C. firm. Phenomenal background, phenomenal guy. And he's going to take a year off at his firm's, with his firm's blessing, and come be one of my clerks. It's hard to believe he's going to start in August, because he contacted me almost immediately after I got on the bench, told me his law firm, I've worked with his law firm on some patent cases, and he said, we think it'd be great. When is there a slot? And it's already coming up. So
that's good advice. Let's say there's a more ambitious listener of this podcast, and his dream is to become the next Judge Allen Albright, let's say maybe a law student or maybe another district court judge somewhere. What advice would you give them? I guess for both.
Don't. No, there is, you would have better luck at me telling you where you can go stand in a state tomorrow to be hit by lightning than, yeah, I could tell you how the number of things that have to align perfectly to become an Article III judge are beyond anyone's capacity to predict. It's just, you know, the combination of who's in the White House, who your senators are, how, you know, what your background is, what, you know, who's in the, who controls the Senate. I look, if I could do that, I think I would have a better chance at guessing all 64 basketball games correctly than I would at being able to predict who might become a federal judge during their career. Just there's too much luck involved. But again, as I've said earlier, anyone could have the same docket I do. I think hard work and certainty, which, you know, my rules, I think, provide. I think that's what parties on both sides are looking for.
So I think it's the advice is if you're not a district court judge, is to be very lucky. And if you are a district court judge, is to work hard and provide certainty. And
I think all federal judges work hard. What I'm saying is you have to decide that it's worth working hard on patent cases, and, you know, which would require a very strange person, I think. So
final question is, law clerk told me to ask you, and I thought it was a very important question. So why should you not wear Python boots to the courthouse?
Unless you're a law clerk. There's a good chance if you do, and I see it, there might be a tiny amount of mocking. There might be a very tiny amount of mocking. I know that I am ethically probably not supposed to comment on what my law clerks wear, but if you wear Python boots, I'm probably not going to be able to restrain myself from making a comment. So I also commented with one law clerk on the fact he wore double vented jackets a lot, which I think is never appropriate. I think a single vent in the back is always the way to go. But we had that discussion quite a bit over his year. Yeah. So
all good advice for future clerks. So,
But you know, maybe you can pull off a pair of Python. If you can pull off a pair of Python boots, then, you know, maybe you're someone really special.
So a brave future clerk might try to get. No,
I think, yeah, sure, go for it. I might give someone extra points in the future if they came in wearing Python boots for an interview, just because I would like their chutzpah.
So maybe the interns should do it to kind of stand out, right?
I think the intern wants to stand out. They ought to try rocking the Python boots. Maybe a different color than the ones I've seen in the past.
That's a bit of wisdom there. All right, well, thank you so much, Judge. I really appreciate it, and thank you for your time.
I enjoyed it very much. Have a great day, and come to Waco. Come see me in Waco.
Oh, I love that.
Okay, take care.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Or if you'd like to learn more about my firm, visit heritylp.com.